Well, I'd like to say that, you know, I'm not just a nutritionist because after almost 19 years at Clay Center with a bunch of geneticists, they pretty well beat me around the head and the ears and let me know that, well, they do have some importance in the field. And I think one of the things that we do have to realize is that we're dealing with a biological system, and there are a lot of components to it. On top of that, we're trying to make money with it, so we're having to plug it into an economic system. One of the exciting things that we saw yesterday was some great opportunities in beef cattle production and moving the cows forward that we didn't have a grasp on how we were going to take some of the information that we have and actually use it. One of the things I don't think that was stressed maybe well enough yesterday was with the genetic markers. One of its powers is its ability to allow us to start to select for traits that are hard and difficult to measure. It's pretty easy to select for growth. You know, you take them, you put them on the scale, you've got a phenotype that you can select on. When we start looking at other characteristics such as cow maintenance or something like that, that's almost impossible to collect that information at the producer level. And so we're going to rely on genetic markers to help us work our way through finding the quote-unquote efficient cow. Now, I'm going to start by telling you the take-home message of this talk right now. That is, there is no perfect cow. Each cow has to fit into your production system. It has to fit into your ecology, your grazing. It has to fit into your management style. And it has to fit into your available resources. When we start thinking about what kind of cow fits our operation, we have to think about what are our inputs, what are our market endpoints, and try to find the type of cow that fits that system. Sounds easy. Not really. When we talk about cows, why are we worried about the cow side? We put a lot of emphasis on the steer. But when we look at the total nutrients that go into the production system of beef production, the vast majority of those nutrients are on the cow side, or on the, including the heifers that we're developing. So consequently, when we start talking about production efficiency and feed efficiency in cattle, we really do need to look at the cow. If we look at the beef cow as far as what we spend per cow unit per year, ballpark figure, it's going to vary across the country and also across different intensities of management systems. We're talking about 70% of your cow annual cow costs being associated with your feed. So with that, I hope I've justified what I'm going to start talking about. let's see. Wow. It works. I'm going to back up, and our previous speaker just was talking about efficiency. You're going to hear us talking about efficiency, and at some point I think we need to define what is efficiency. And for my purposes today, I'm going to define efficiency in what I kind of call the classic term of outputs over inputs. Now, one thing that we do have to emphasize is we have biological efficiency and we have economic efficiency. To understand how to take full advantage of the economic efficiencies, we have to understand the biological efficiencies of the cow so that we can then weight the inputs and the outputs to come up with the optimum economic efficiency. It's important to underline the fact that the economic efficiency and the biological efficiency are not necessarily equal. Now, a lot of us know that. It gets back to how much hay are you going to run out to your cows? Are we going to buy cows that we put into our operation that we have to supplemental feed in order to get a reasonable weight calf to market or to increase the weight of calf? And That's where we come into the, again, those economic components of it, where maybe we select a cow that's not right for that environment. But we select her because we put additional inputs into the system that gives us a more valuable product at the back end of market. Now, I don't even want to pretend to be an economist. I'm not even going to go there. I frequently try not to even pretend to be a geneticist. I got a few that can help me over here. But what I do want to do this morning is talk about some of the variation that we do see in cows and what we have to think about when we're selecting cows. Now, I kind of throw it into two general categories for today. Factors affecting cow efficiency. One is feed efficiency, and the other one is what I'm calling production life. You can call it stability, whatever you want to call it. Those are two major components that determine the both the biological and economic efficiency of the cow herd. Now, this is my matchbook cover version of why we're interested in production life on the cow herd. If we have, just say we keep a cow for 10 years, we have a 20% replacement rate, and we sketch out how much value we've gotten out of her calves, how much feed we're putting into her, typically we're not breaking even until we breed that cow around 5 years of age, breed her fifth time. That means that two-thirds of our cows have not gotten to the point where we're in a break-even situation with them. You know, you think about that as far as an investment. That's a five-year investment to get even. And dealing with heifer costs and everything. And, you know, we can plug all other kinds of assumptions in here, salvage value and that type of thing. But the point is if you're going to develop a heifer, keep her, and you're going to keep her for about 10 years, and we're on that 20% replacement rate, you've got about a third of your cows that are making you money. So, what attributes contribute to production life? One of the things that we have to kind of start working away from if we want to implement the genomic selection is to get away from looking at values that are indexes or have many subcomponents. And one of the reasons for that is we can't really come up with genetic markers for stability or production life because they don't have a biological basis. What we need are the components of these indexes. Now, the very first thing on my list, I kind of violate that. I have fertility. Well, we all know that fertility is made up of a lot of different components. Embryonic loss, the ability of the cow to settle, puberty, postpartum interval. But the point is if we want to take advantage of those genomic markers, we also have to be active in collecting these types of phenotypes so that we can go back and connect them with those SNPs, because we have no opportunity, really, to connect those SNPs to these larger index values like stability, because there's going to be so many of them. Other things that are going to determine whether or not we keep that cow is the weight of calf weaned. Now, this, again, has a number of different components. It's her mothering ability. It's going to be her ability to milk. So, again, we need to actually start looking at some of the subcomponents and those phenotypes if you're going to take advantage of the markers. Udder structure and health is another one. Can she milk? Will that mammary stay good for 10 years? Feet and legs, and both the feet and legs and the health of those, as well as the animal health. Dental wear, and you know, the bottom line is she doesn't have the utensils, she can't get the groceries. And temperament. And temperament, I know there were some talks this week on that as well. So temperament with respect to the animal's flight and their use of energy because of uneasiness, as well as just temperament and handling. Now, I'm going to jump into components of feed efficiency on the cow, and this is probably the area that I enjoy the most and most comfortable with. If you look at the white graph on the bottom, that's the indication of kind of a typical forage production scheme. And I know out here we're on a lot of Mediterranean annuals, and we see a very similar type of curve for forage production. If you look at the yellow line up on the top, that's the annual metabolizable energy requirement of the cow. And you can see it varies over the seasons. Now, one of the things that we can do first is, if we want to start talking about cow efficiency and managing cows more efficiently, is to move those requirements to match our forage and take a better advantage of our grazed forages. A lot of times that hasn't made sense. If in the farm belt, we typically calve fairly early in the spring. And the reason we do that, for the most part, is historical. Because by mid to late spring, we needed to be in the field. So you wanted to have your calving done. I never understood why we were here in California. We calved in October. It made no sense to me why we calved in October. It was many years later, after I'd gone to college, I said, "Dad, why did we calve in October?" "Well, it was easy. I like to take vacation in August." So, you know, it gets to be a situation of bringing in other components that are important into the operation and making it fit in the whole operation. But if you want to take advantage of your grazed forages, you need to get your production system matched up with your grazed forages. And that may come at the detriment of taking vacation in August. Now, let's talk about the annual metabolizable energy requirements of the cow. This is the same graph that you just saw, but I've broken it down into its components. You can see the bottom section in yellow. That's the big one, maintenance. And we'll talk a little bit more about each of these. The green bar above it is activity. We typically think about this as grazing and walking. You can also throw in the temperament component in there. There's some management components that will increase or decrease this section as well. For example, water tank placement, density of forage. So how much time does cattle have to spend? There's also behavioral components, which we assume are genetic and time spent feeding, time of day spent feeding. Are the cattle heat tolerant? Can they go out and nibble all day? Or does it get in the middle of the day and you find them under a tree and they're done for the day? So while I've got that as a fixed amount, there really is a fair bit of fluctuation in that green component. I thought it was rather appropriate to put milk and white, and we have a fair bit of energy going into milk, and then of course red going is the fetal energy. Now, I need to back up just a little bit. This is all being expressed as metabolizable energy. Now, for those of you that aren't used to looking at metabolizable energy, that's the amount of energy that actually enters the cow's body after digestion. So it's what gets into the cow's body. It's, you know, fairly closely related to TDN and digestible energy, but this is what we're talking about, actually gets into the cow's body. And once that energy gets into the cow's body, it has two fates. It can either go into tissue, so for example, into milk or fetus or muscle or fat, or it's released as heat. I like using metabolizable energy as an index of nutrient use in the animal. You know, we've got to keep in mind that there are specific nutrient requirements for proteins, given amino acids, vitamins, etc. But this gives us an overall good index of nutritional status of the animal. Now, what's this mean on an annual basis? If we look over here on our bar graph to the right, that means about 64% of the metabolizable energy that we put into that cow each year is used for maintenance. Roughly 13% is going to be used for activity. 8% of that metabolizable energy is going towards the fetus. And about 15% that we're putting in is going towards milk. Now, back to that simple part. I've got a simple approach on this. If I'm going to make some difference on cow efficiency, I'm probably going to go after the big piece, and that's maintenance. So, what is maintenance? A cow is at maintenance when she is neither gaining or losing energy. In simple terms, no change in body weight. So, when a cow is at maintenance, inputs are your feed energy, and your outputs are heat. The animal is neither gaining or losing. She's only giving off heat. What are some of the factors affecting cow maintenance? We know cow size does. We know milk production potential affects them. And we know that there are genetic differences in maintenance. Let's talk about what drives maintenance as far as biologically. In the animal, in us, tissue is constantly being synthesized and degraded. So the protein in our body is constantly being broken down, rebuilt. Same thing with our fat. Now, to just kind of bring it home, for most of us, we are at maintenance. You think about it. Over the course of a year, we typically hold our body weight, and so the food energy, our metabolizable energy we're taking in, is going in, giving off as heat. We do have short-term changes. I'm sure that when I return home, I'll find out the last 3 days I was not at maintenance. And we will have to do a little adjustment. But the point is that when those processes of synthesis and degradation are occurring, it is not 100% efficient. And that's why you have that heat being given off, and that is the required metabolizable energy for maintenance. That's the biological reason for it. Now, it becomes pretty obvious the more tissue that is maintained, the more food energy that is required to maintain the tissue. In white, what's that mean? Bigger cows take more feed to maintain. I'm not telling you guys anything different that you already know. So, just to give you a picture of how that works, we've got two cows here. We've got a cow, let's say about 1,100 pounds in white. We've got a 1,600-pound cow on the top in yellow. And over on the right-hand side is a rough estimate of what that cow's maintenance those two cows' maintenance requirements are. And this is just a diagram to show you the relative difference in that 500-pound increase in maintenance requirement for the cow. What's that mean as far as a feed resource? Well, we're talking approximately 6 pounds of hay, grass hay a day, more to maintain that larger cow. We've gone through various phases in the industry, and this is the point where I want to say that we've got a situation where decisions that we make at certain points in the industry will affect other components of the industry, and it may not always be in a positive way. One of our answers to getting bigger weaned calves historically has been to use bigger bulls, that get larger weaning weights. One of the things that's interesting about these growth curves is they're highly conserved across breeds. At a given age, the animal has reached a similar proportion of their maturity, regardless of what their mature weight ultimately is going to be. So one of the easiest ways to increase pounds of calf that you're weaning at a given age is to increase the cow size. And so when we go through a selection or go through a program where we're using larger cattle, the result will be that we're going to end up with larger cows. We're going to drive up the maintenance requirement of our herd. Now, I throw this graph up, and I apologize, there's some red lines in there that are hard to see, and I realized that that was going to be the issue, but I had already turned in my stick to the organizers to load my presentation, and boy, you should have seen them. They got that stick, and they weren't going to give it back. You've been hearing about it, you know, and I don't blame the guys this afternoon. I can see why they're worried about it. I almost lost a finger on the whole thing. But you've heard about curve bending. And curve bending bulls or something, or bender bulls and that type of thing. What's that entail? Well, when it's done right, what we're looking at is a situation where we increase the growth rate early in the calf, but we maintain a lower cow weight. There's been some evidence that that's occurring in some of the lines of cattle. But we've seen very clear evidence of this in sheep, where in breed selection, where we've seen various breeds that mature very rapidly early and then plane off. So this is the concept of curve bending, where we keep the cow herd size small, but we increase the rate of gain so that they mimic a larger type of cow or genetics through the critical period of marketing. Now, having said all of that, I want to emphasize big cows are not bad. This gets back to what are your production inputs. And this is some data taken from Jenkins and Farrell's work in the late 80s, early 90s, where on the bottom axis you have different levels of dry matter intake, and then we look at weaned calf per cow exposed on the response axes. And what you see is that at low intakes that these lighter weight cows had an advantage in the amount of product produced per cow. However, as we get out to these larger cows, as we increase our inputs, if we've got them available, they outperform the smaller cows. This gets back to don't find yourself getting into a selection index that's pushing cow size down if you have the resources for these larger animals. They may make economic sense to you. Now, what do we know? There's genetic differences in maintenance as well. One of the things we do know is that there's an increase with increased milk production is correlated with an increase in maintenance in non-pregnant and non-lactating cows. Why is that important? These cows aren't doing anything. They're sitting still. But their maintenance requirements are still higher. A 5-pound increase in peak milk yield represents approximately a 17% increase in maintenance. Metabolic energy requirements, if we look at some work again of Farrell and Jenkins back from the early 80s, what we see is some of these cattle that had some higher milk potentials, they have a higher maintenance requirement. So, what's this mean? Well, it means that if you're working on a situation where you don't have the resources to support these cows with high milk, and you don't have the inputs, you need to avoid these big cows, or not just big cows, these cows with high milk that have these higher maintenance requirements that aren't going to perform as well at that low intake. If you have the inputs, then these cows are going to be to your advantage. What do we know? What's driving this? There's some biology behind it. What I threw up here is a bar graph. PDB stands for portal drain viscera. It's basically the guts, if you will. The middle component is the liver, and the bigger portion is the body. But this is the percent of oxygen, or energy, if you will, that's distributed by tissues. One of the things that we know is in these cows that have a high genetic potential for milk, one of the organs that's extremely large as a proportional weight is liver. And as you can see, the liver is taking about 25% of the total energy. So one of the things you've got to be careful about is when we start selecting cows, if we start selecting cows down on maintenance, if we express it as heat production per unit body weight, you have the potential of depressing the cow's production ability when she gets out, when those resources are available. And the same thing potentially with her calves when they go into the lot. The way I like to kind of describe it is if you take a engine out of a Corolla and you put it into a Corvette, it may look like a Corvette, but it's going to run like a Corolla. And it's going to have the same performance. So I think that when we start putting these selection indexes together with genetic markers, I would caution you about just jumping on and saying we've got to drive maintenance down. Now, we can maintain lighter weight cattle. This is kind of a management approach. We can go to a body condition score 5, down from a 6. And what we see is we do save some energy on a daily basis. And we've done a little work on that where we've taken, say, 20-30% of the feed in a 112-day period, restricted it from the animal, and then gave it back in the next 112 days. And what we see is no net difference in total energy gained by those cows. But the point that I want to caution you here is there's no net difference in energy received, but I'm going to skip that slide because it's the same take-home message, but you're still using the same amount of feed. Genetic variations, we also have genetic variation in the ability of the cow to adjust, and this is what I call the rubber band cow. We have two types of cattle here. You can see that metabolic rate on one is low, but as we increase feed, it gets high. So we've got some genetic differences there. Yes, I'm flying along. Milk yield. Milk is a big component of it, and total milk production is going to drive the energy costs associated with milk. But one of the things we need to look at as we go is the persistency of lactation. And one of the things I just want to point out is the efficiency of milk production in beef cattle is essentially the same as it is in dairy cattle. So that's highly conserved there. We're not looking at increasing the efficiency biologically. An example of persistency of lactation. I have two milk curves here, one for Belgian Blue, one for Brahma cattle. Their total milk production over this 150-day period is essentially the same. However, what we've done is, with the Brahma cattle, we've increased the persistency. The milk later into lactation is greater there. And consequently, what we've done is provided a high-protein feed, if you will, to that calf out on pasture, and we get an advantage of weaning weights when we do that. Just to kind of wrap it up, there is considerable biological diversity among cows for maintenance and milk production. Development of marker-assisted technologies offer an opportunity to select cows for difficult-to-measure traits like maintenance. Fitting cows to your operation requires defining your resources and market endpoints, and then fitting the biological type to your environment. And finally, a good cow in one production environment may not be a good cow in another environment. Thank you.